I'm Jay Hughes, producer of Change Surfer Radio, and for the next half hour, I'll be your guide to a sexy high-tech vision of a radically democratic future, brought to you by the Institute for Ethics and Emerging Technologies. Welcome to Change Surfer Radio. This is the first half of my interview with Eitan Edwards. He's the executive director of the International Preparedness Network, and we talk about how people can prepare for disasters. I'm speaking today with Eitan Edwards. He is the executive director of a New York City-based disaster preparedness organization called the International Preparedness Network, and he's the author of a book called Preparedness Now. Welcome, Eitan.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Well, it's a delight. I tell you that on this show, we've talked about a number of different kinds of global catastrophic risks, from international weapons of mass destruction and plague and various kinds of things. And over the years, I've become increasingly interested, both as a sociologist and for, just actual preparedness reasons to get people thinking about these things, in this topic of how we prepare. And you got interested in this from a number of sources, as I understand it, that will probably fascinate my listeners. So I wanted to ask you first about how H.G. Wells's The Shape of Things to Come, a novel that is a big inspiration for futurists and for science fiction fans. How did that play into your thinking?
Well, you know, I mean, I'd always been, since I was younger, fascinated with, old H.G.'s work from, Time Machine. And, it was required reading at the time when I was in grade school. And, and you go through this list and then all of a sudden, bam, this strange book is the original draft, The Shape of Things to Come, is very much like a dictation of, it wasn't like the movie itself. It was more of a, almost like a draft of something that was recorded. But I was fascinated by it, because it was a piece that H.G. Created to project what he thought that the possible future could be. And I've always been fascinated with what, what could happen in the future. So that was a major inspiration. And then when I saw the movie, that was it for me. That's one of the things. I mean, the movie itself was incredibly motivating because, of course, it was made in 1933, and the effects were incredible. It was a powerful stimulus it was really something that I was just completely awed by, because of even the special effects and everything else that was involved in the creation of the show. So, and that was another thing. Then Buckminster Fuller was another inspiration, because Buckminster Fuller, he with not just the people kind of assume that he created the geodesic dome, was actually created for the Carl Zeiss company in Switzerland by an astronomer. But his perfection of the geodesic dome and the use of it and some of his principles and the development of these, homes that are basically churned out like machines, and I just thought that was fantastic. So these are the principal inspirations. But then it was my father, who was also involved in the Strategic Air Command, who, quite honestly, there was a point, even though I was very young, but I can still kind of vaguely remember him speaking to my mother and telling her that in 1963, that it's over. I can still pick those words out. It's over.
When the Cuban Missile Crisis was
right.
happening.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that, he wasn't coming home. And probably wasn't, But the fact is, so I've been around this all my life.
Did he try to get your family to prepare for a nuclear war?
Well, not until, afterwards that I remember having conversations with him about this and how, we might not have, eventually that we were going to see some sort of a, nuclear exchange, and that we have to always be ready for these things. And then growing up in the 60s and, watching things just, fall apart around me. I just kind of presumed that this is the way of the world. So I was fascinated, always fascinated with, this string of stuff. There were a lot of apocalyptic themed things in the culture at the time. There was Planet of the Apes, Soylent Green. Soylent Green was the 70s. Planet of the Apes was incredibly impacting. Another thing, even though it was popular culture, but it was still you know, boom, I'm this kid sitting in the theater, and it, you know, at the end of the film when the character rides into the beach and runs into a Statue of Liberty buried in the sand, it's just like, wow, I just thought this was my future. So my coping mechanism was, well, I'm going to figure out a way to kind of like live through all of that stuff, you know. And that's a very, you know, it's encapsulating everything, but it was basically the principle of where this all started. Because when people ask me, you know, I've been doing this for quite a while, and, you know, and strangely enough, I just literally completed shooting a Discovery Channel special, and I was sitting at the round table with some of the producers, and they were asking me, how long have you been in this? I said, it depends on how you look at it. If you want to look at it from the formal standpoint in terms of teaching people, it's been 20 years. But if you want to look at it from the standpoint of me doing this or being involved in it, you'd really have to go back to when I was a child. And just very, very profound moments in my life that I can pick out. When I remember going to see the movie Deliverance. That was a huge influence. I mean, you got to be ready. You got to be ready. When I was a kid, listening to Creedence Clearwater Revival and Bad Moon Rising, and I can remember the first time I heard this song, and I said, that's going to be my future. So,
just to flip back to Shape of Things to Come and Bucky Fuller, you're touching on kind of two of the parallel themes in apocalyptic fiction. In H.G. Wells' novel, there's a global war with weapons of mass destruction where he kind of foretells nuclear mm-hmm. war. But then civilization gets knitted back together by international technologically sophisticated group of people. And Bucky Fuller had a similar kind of vision that engineering, kind of appropriate technology engineering, could solve humanity's problems. And so there's that kind of direction. And then there's the direction where we all deserve it. We're going to get whacked, and we're going to have to learn to live like cavemen again, or pastoralism, technological civilization is the problem. And you seem to be coming down in your work clearly on the side of, optimism about our ability to put things back together in a sustainable way.
Absolutely. I think we can. Whether we choose to do it is, you know, still subject to debate, right? I mean, it's one of these things where humans have to make a choice. And in fact, that H.G., define this quite well, you know, in the things to come. And people have to make this distinct choice. What do they want? And I do come down on the side of, yes, we have the ability to pretty much fix every problem that we've got, but humanity is going to have to recognize what it needs to do and to commit itself to doing it, because we are at a crossroads here. And I think that we're at a more dangerous period than we were even during the Cold War. Because, you know, everything is amorphous. There's no shape or form to anything anymore. You know, at the time it was Russia versus the United States, United States versus Russia and China. But it's not the same world. And you have this, you know, these different groups, these terroristic groups, which I don't even like to refer to, because, again, it's all literally relative. I mean, one man's terrorist is another man's freedom fighter. So they don't consider themselves to be terrorists. We consider them to be terrorists because they're attacking us. And this has to do with policy and politics and religion and everything else. But these people, you know, they're people who will get hold of weapons of mass destruction if they don't already have them, and they will use them. And we don't know what that can trigger. Like, I'm very concerned about the floods in Pakistan because, again, here we have a situation that the government's being destabilized, and now you have these elements within the government, the jihadists and different terroristic organizations, quote, terroristic organizations that are now picking up the ball where the government has it and helping to feed and clothe and house the people. What does that mean 6 months from now? Does that mean that Pakistan falls and then the weapons are out? So we're in serious trouble. And to boot global warming and everything else, the destruction of the environment and the fallout from that, the global warming and the water crisis, the fresh water crisis, the food crisis and all these different things that we're going to have to contend with, it's like a cobalt bomb, multiple cobalt bombs blowing up in different locations.
Well, this seems to distinguish what you do from a lot of the other survivalist subcultural types of things that are out there. A lot of that subculture is right wing. It's like, you know, NRA, they're coming to take our guns. Obama's a socialist, you know, prepare for Jesus, live in Idaho kind of people. I don't want to cast aspersions too widely. I mean, I know that sounds like just like they might think of me as a latte sipping liberal. But, you know, what you are about seems to be plugged into an awareness of climate change. It's plugged into an awareness of the natural disasters that are occurring all the time in the developing world that, you know, hardly make a blip on most Americans' consciousness. And you're actually trying to do something about it and put and apply the skills that you have been trying to develop for Americans to prepare for urban preparedness. And this project that really struck me was your one about preparing low-cost disaster homes for developing world disaster situations. Can you talk about that, the Life One project?
Oh, yeah. Life One, you know, Life One started with my son when he was born in 1998. And, you know, I thought that Buckminster Fuller did, that the housing situation, the global housing situation, is one of the most pressing problems that we have. And, you know, also watching a number of my friends struggling to pay their mortgages and such. And I knew that there were certain skills that I developed that, you know, unfortunately aren't really taught. It's something that you have to learn on your own. And, you know, that in terms of the geodesic dome building, but also some of the other things that are related to that. And I knew that, you know, if housing is this problem and looking at Bucky Fuller's model, there's a way to improve and maybe and modernize and some of the things that he did. And I said, I got to figure out ways to make, you know, houses. Like, I was very concerned about the plastics issue, which, you know, obviously anyone who's aware of any environmental problems is, in terms of like the North Pacific Gyre, and that huge, you know, just blob of plastic that's just floating in the Pacific Ocean. And I didn't know what can we do about these things. We've got to learn how to, we've got to recycle that, we've got to use it. So I started to kind of like model homes that could be built with a lot of the waste material. I mean, automobiles, taking the sheet metal, and how do you basically paste together something that could not only be built by anyone with, let's say, a minimal amount of skill, but also a minimal amount of cost, and something that can be taken apart and reassembled and moved, and it can float, and it can do all these different things. That, you know, one of the problems with the third world and developing countries is flooding, and the flooding not only destroys the landscape, but it, you know, destroys the homes. And you can't root the home into the ground. If the home could float and you can anchor it, then you can conceivably keep the home. So I made sure that, you know, these things, these designs, that the homes could float. You could pick them up. You could pack them up in cars. And they're modular. They can connect with one another. I'm looking at my kids' stuff. It's like Tinker Toys. We need to be able to build houses like that. So that's where that project, you know, Life One. And you know, and over the years, you know, the problem has, as it always is with any NGO or not-for-profit, it's funding, funding, funding. And it's been this slow climb, you know, to try to, you know, to keep the money flowing to maintain this work. I mean, I would have been able to do more so much sooner had I been able to fund stuff, but it's been a slow climb. But now we're at the point where we got into not only the Life One, but we're now in this ultra-low-cost home-building thing because it has applications for Americans as well. Is now we have tent cities all over the place, you know. And I don't see the situation improving anytime soon. I think that the situation is going to get worse as you know, the economy continues to spiral downward. And people need to have something available to them where you can get off-the-shelf components and build a home for a few thousand dollars as opposed to spending, you know, $100,000 for a house that has to cut down, you know, 150 trees and this much paint and all this type of stuff. So that's what we're doing now. So the Life One project has evolved into that as well. And I think that it's I'm really looking forward to kind of deploying it. I mean, we've been playing with a lot of different things. I found someone in Canada who has a steel company, and they're willing to work. You know, it's hard to find people that would actually do something that experimental. But I found this wonderful person in Canada who not only was going to help us with the Haitian situation, he had offered to supply us with steel to build geodesic domes in Haiti at cost. In other words, he's not trying to make a profit. He's just basically trying to making sure that he's breaking even. But he's also willing to help with this, and that's a wonderful thing. So we can kind of play around with a lot of different designs and come up with something that, you know, ultimately my goal is for people to be able to go to a Home Depot or a Lowe's to get one of these kits and to build themselves a home. And I'll be quite frankly, the stuff that I've got on, you know, paper and the models, I mean, to me, it's a hell of a lot more attractive than most of the homes that people are already living in. It's more modern, you know, it's not, you don't have to worry about termites. You know, it's insulated, it's easy to assemble. You can put one together in a couple days, you can take it apart. And it's a machine, like with Bucky Fuller. It's a machine. It's more of a machine than a home, but it does have an aesthetic quality that, you know, one of the things that we had to maintain when I was working on the designs of these things, and I said, you know what, there's got to be, it has to have aesthetic value. It has to have a beauty, a form. And I think that Bucky Fuller, had he had the time, he would have been able to work on that aspect a little bit more, because people need that, because that's the only way it can sell. It can only work if, you know, for Americans anyway. I think that the third world and the developing nations, all they care about is really good shelter. But in terms of American neighborhoods, a lot of people have problems with geodesic domes. And oftentimes neighborhoods will come together and say, we don't want that thing in our community with that weird structure. And I didn't want this to kind of fall into the same pot, so that's what we did. So Life One's on the move, man, and, you know, I'm getting, like, good news about it every day. One of the biggest developments, I don't want to jinx it right now, but there's a major development that just happened, and, you know, if it works out well, then, you know, maybe that people will be watching this on television within the next 3 to 4 months as to what we're doing.
I'm speaking with Eitan Edwards. This is Change Surfer Radio. I'm Dr. J. Eitan is the director of International Preparedness Network. Let's talk a little bit about International Preparedness Network. It got started in 1989. What do you do? You run global meltdown survival clinics. Those sound like a heck of a lot of fun.
And that didn't start until, like, recently. But initially, when we started, it was a FEMA program that was called the Civilian Disaster Managers Program. And effectively, what they wanted you to do was to go into communities and teach people what you knew about disaster preparedness. You know, it was a way to kind of like formalize the group. So what we did was we joined it and we started up. But we found that FEMA's programs were left a bit to be desired in terms of some of the stuff that they did was kind of antiquated, kind of a throwback to the 1950s videos that they used to have, like the duck and cover thing. I mean, you know, that's how bad it was at the time. So we kind of like used a lot of the circle that I had at the time and still do, like ex-military people, Sergeant Tony Flowers from the Marine Corps, and Ryan Barco from Special Forces and police and everybody. We kind of like modernized what the techniques into something that was a little bit more real world. And then we just went out on our own and did it. And the rest is history. We taught the civilians and professionals how to mitigate against and respond to the full spectrum of disasters and emergencies. And then about 1990, like in 98, that's when I started to say, you know, we got to put the domes in and the Life One program started. And you know, after 2001, after 9/11, things really took off in terms of people wanting to join and get involved.
As I understand it, you were predicting that something was going to happen in New York City around the time of 2001, so you had a little prescience.
I mean, you know, it's funny because when people say, "What are you, a psychic or something?" I said it had nothing to do with that. It had to do with a careful analysis of information and data that I'd received over the course of the past 5 years about these terrorist groups, about the techniques that they use, discussions that have been had in regards to what they wanted to do to the United States. Like for instance, in 1989, there was a terroristic organization that had decided they wanted to crash an aircraft into the Eiffel Tower, and they were going to use it as a missile. And that had been discussed among like groups like Al Qaeda and Osama bin Laden had actually said these kinds of things. It's not like this is something that was secret. I mean, FEMA had a book with literally a picture of like the World Trade Center towers on the cover and speaking about preparedness and skyscraper safety. This stuff had been discussed within the auspices of NORAD and all these different organizations. It wasn't a secret, So I got these booklets. I was part of FEMA. I got this stuff. I got intel from, you know, military friends and family and all kinds of folks within the loop. And I just analyzed it, and I said, okay, this is what's going to happen. And that's how I did it. And I went on this program called KISS in February of 2001 and basically laid out exactly what I thought could occur. And I told a caller that I thought that something could happen. It would probably be around the first or the second week of September because that's when everybody's back in the city. It'll happen in the morning. And when she said, what do you think will happen? I said, I don't know what it can be. It could be anything. But the one place I wouldn't want to be is the World Trade Center because that's the target that they're looking at. And she said, why did you say that? Because they tried to blow it up before. And I said, well, they're persistent. And the fact is that they can get creative. Maybe they'll get hold of a tactical nuke. Or they could get creative and fly a jumbo jet to the side of the building, like they were going to do the Eiffel Tower. Now, I prefaced it with that. I said the Eiffel Tower, but everybody's like, you know, how did he do that? It's like all the information was there. So when Condoleezza Rice got up there and she said, you know, in the media, oh, we didn't know. And of course they did. There were people that knew. There were
memos.
Say again, there were memos, there were books, there were the CIA knew, the FBI, there were elements within the FBI that knew that something was up. You know, the Mossad knew, the German intelligence knew, the French intelligence knew. They knew something was up. There was a lot of chatter. And basically the Bush administration chose to just basically sit on their hands and just to see if something was going to happen. It has to do with arrogance and incompetence, and that's what happened. So, I mean, I've been on top of this kind of data for a long time. But
let me ask you about that. I mean, if you were in the towers, basically no amount of preparedness was going to do anything for you. But if you were in the area, it would have been nice to have some masks, some filters, which is one of the standard go kit kind of things that you advise people have. Can you lay out a number of different kinds of disasters that that people might think about and the kinds of different kinds of preparedness that you try to get people to think about?
Well, the one thing I would disagree with you with one thing. If you were in the towers, there are certain things that could have, I can tell you right off of the bat, for the people who survived without injury, you know, and a lot of them did. There were a number of things that could have saved even more lives, stuff that they could have had on their person that would have allowed them to, like, maybe navigate their way through these smoky areas and to get out, like a smoke hood, a smoke escape hood. And this is something that, you know, it was expensive at the time, but it's something that I had spoken about and carried. Which is a smoke hood is like a gas mask. It's a filter, but it's designed to provide you with breathable air for about 20 minutes in the midst of a, like, you know, raging fire. You can have a breathable air. It's still smoke tainted, but it's not toxic enough to kill you. And a good flashlight and a smoke hood would conceivably have saved a couple hundred more people. But in the other instance, you know, what I would say that everyone, like, you know, you hear this from the government, but everybody needs to have what they call a grab-and-go or 72-hour bag, which is a bag that you have in your home that allows you to kind of, like, live for 72 hours. If you had to snatch it out of your house, you could live for, like, 3 days without having any assistance. There's enough food in there. You have water purification tablets. You have a little bit of water. And you have your, you know, incidental things, you know, toiletries, first aid. Emergency radio and flashlight and some small tools. Then there's the personal kit, and everyone should have a personal kit where they're carrying, you know, at least a little flashlight, non-incendive, something that can't spark a fire, a gas fire, because often people don't recognize that using a flashlight, that a normal flashlight that can spark a fire. When you press that button down, there's if you're in an environment that may have gas, you could actually spark an explosion. And a non-incendive flashlight is usually like something that's completely waterproof, not water-resistant. A whistle, if you needed help, to carry that in your person. To have a little bit of cord, something that you can tie something down. It's called 550-pound paracord. And a multi-tool, which is a little wrench slash little tiny knife slash screwdrivers and file and everything else that everyone can carry in their pocket. A good sturdy pouch. A lighter. Some folded ducks or folded over duct tape, and you're set. You know, just these little things can actually help you through. And then, of course, having a smoke hood would help. I would also say that people who live in large cities, especially like here in New York, that's a target for stuff that they've been speaking about for years, like dirty bombs. it's always good to carry some sort of respiratory protection, and that would include any kind of a particulate mask that has a rating of NP or R95 or higher. It goes up to N100, R100, or P100. And the letters basically indicate whether it's partially or fully resistant to organic mists. N means it's not resistant to any mist at all, but it's a dust filter. And those are things you can purchase at a Home Depot for a few dollars, $3, $4 a mask, carry it in your pocket, and you always have respiratory protection. I mean, it goes further than that, but you have
checklists for these kinds of things at the Preparedness Now book website.
Yes.
Are they also at the readyforanything.org website?
Yeah, if you go into the preparedness section, then you can see the checklist there, and people can go in there and see what you should have.
And you break it out in terms of a go kit for your home, a go kit for your office, a go kit for your car.
Right, and a go kit for you, because, again, your most personal kit is your kit, is the one that you carry with you at all times. And that's because when the disaster strikes, you know, you're probably not going to be in your house. You're going to be in your office, or you're going to be, someplace else. And, depending on how much time you spend at home, of course, that's dependent on whether you would be there. But you've got to be ready at all times, and the only way to do that is if you have something that you carry with you at all times. And this is something that you never leave anywhere. But it doesn't compromise you, because it takes up, you know, about as much space as a wallet when you pack it right. It's about that much space. And there's really no reason that people shouldn't have that. Even like I give people a little thing like this thing called an Osho toothbrush, which is a toothbrush that you can essentially fill up with toothpaste. And, because personal hygiene products and toiletries, one of the first things to go. And if you go to any disaster site, you know, you will see that that in the disaster site that people, the first thing that they're looking for is a toothbrush. And oftentimes that one toothbrush means a lot to them. And the fact is that having this Osho, you can always carry around a toothbrush with toothpaste in it, and there's at least enough toothpaste in that thing to last a good week. And it's very small. It looks like a pen. You wouldn't even notice. It's spelled O-S-H-O, and you can order it online. So everybody in Japan has one. And it's something, a personal hygiene item, that everybody should carry at all times. And the fact is, even with all this stuff, it still doesn't take up as much space as... It's not the size of a bag. It can fit in your hand. It can fit in your back pocket. If you're female, then it can fit in your purse, and nobody'd even know you had it. I mean, you could even carry around a water filter in your pocket, and nobody'd know you had it. So there's really no excuse.
This was the first half of my interview with Eitan Edwards of the International Preparedness Network. For the second half of the interview, go to IET.org. You've been listening to Change Surfer Radio, a sexy high-tech vision of a radically democratic future brought to you by the Institute for Ethics and Emerging Technologies and produced at WHUS Stores at the University of Connecticut. I'm Jay Hughes, the host and producer of Change Surfer Radio and executive director of the IET. If you want to learn more about the techno-progressive perspective of Change Surfer Radio and the IET, or you want to share your thoughts about our programs, email me at director@ieet.org. You can find the Institute for Ethics and Emerging Technologies at ieet.org. You can subscribe to a weekly podcast of Change Surfer Radio and listen to or download all of our shows since 1998, thanks to archive.org. So educate, agitate, and organize, and I hope to meet you in a sexy, high-tech, and yet radically democratic future.